So do you think, should we move on to the Chanki Sutta? Yeah? Chanki being a much more substantial and interesting sutta. So we'll see how we go with this. We might not make it all the way through, but we'll just see how we go with the Chanki Sutta. Analia's introduction here, the Chanki Sutta reports of the Buddha explaining how to preserve and arrive at truth. This discourse does not appear to have a parallel in the Chinese Agamas. However, considerable parts of the discourse have been preserved in the Sanskrit fragments, which stem from two different versions of the discourse. So we have at least two. Here we have a few, these are different Sanskrit fragments here. So these are just different editions of it, but the basic one is that one is the Chanki Sutta of the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravadins, and the other one being the from the Dirga Agama of the Sarvastivadins. Both of these being manuscripts which have been recovered from the sort of Gandhara area around Afghanistan and emerged in fairly recent times. And of course, this is an interesting kind of byline, but the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravadins, the idea of the Lokuttaravada was the idea that the Buddha was transcendent, that he was kind of big in every kind of respect, yeah, and they kind of inflated the Buddha beyond the human. And I don't think it's any coincidence that it was the Mahasanghikas who made the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan, which were, of course, destroyed by the Taliban a number of years ago. And so that region, the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravadins, were quite prominent. And this is the same area that the scripture came from, so from the same group of people who constructed those Buddhas. Okay, so let's come to this sutta itself and see how much of this that Google wants to let us read. Okay, that's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the coastline country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually he arrived at the coastline Brahmin village named Opasada. There the Blessed One stayed in the God's Grove, the sala tree grove to the north of Opasada. So the idea of the God's Grove probably being, as so often in ancient India, a sacred grove where offerings would be made to the local deities, Deva Vana. On that occasion, Brahman Chanki was ruling over Opasada, a crown property abounding in living beings, rich in grasslands, woodlands, waterways and grain, a royal endowment, a sacred grant given to him by King Pasenadi of Kosala. The Brahmin householders of Opasada heard the recluse Gotama has appeared and so on, the stock passage, and then saying that it's good to see such arahants. And then they had set out to see the Buddha. On that occasion, Brahman Chanki had retired to the upper story of his palace for his midday rest. He saw the Brahman householders going out. He asked them why they were going, and then he says, "Please wait, and I'll come with you." Then, again, these are all stock passages found in various places, particularly characteristic of the Digha Nikaya. And if you've read the Digha, then these things are found very often. Then one group of 500 Brahmins heard that Chanki was going up to see the Buddha. They asked him about it, and then they criticized him for it, basically saying that he was too high class to be going to see the Buddha. And then Chanki replied saying, these are the reasons why I should go and see him. This bit's not found in the preview we have here. Saying that the Buddha is well born on both sides of pure maternal and paternal descent for seven generations. The recluse Gotama went forth abandoning much gold and bullion and so on. He went forth while still young. He is handsome, comely and graceful, possessing supreme beauty of complexion, with sublime beauty and sublime presence, remarkable to behold. He's virtuous with noble virtue, a good speaker with good delivery, speaking words that are courteous, distinct, flawless, and communicate the meaning. He is a teacher of the teachers of many. He's free from sensual lust. He teaches the doctrine of the moral efficacy of action. And he doesn't seek to harm Brahmins. He went forth from an aristocratic family. People come from many districts to see him. Thousands of devas have gone to refuge for him. And the reputation has spread about that he is an arahant and fully enlightened. He possesses the 32 marks of a great man. King Seni Bimbisara, King Pepsasenidhi, and the Brahmin Pokharasati and others have gone for refuge to life to the recluse Gotama, and he is staying here. And he also finishes up by saying that now recluses and Brahmins that come to our town are our guests, and guests should be honoured, respected, venerated, and revered. Since he has arrived at Opasada, he is our guest, and our guest should be revered by us. So this is why it's proper for me to go and see him. And this is the praise of Master Gotama that I've learnt, but actually the praise of him is not limited to that, but is immeasurable. And this is why it's proper for me to go and see him. Therefore, sirs, let us all go to see the recluse Gotama. So they all went to see him. Now, as I mentioned, this kind of opening is very typical of the Digha Nikaya, and it's not surprising, therefore, that one of the two Sanskrit versions of this actually belongs to the Dirgha Agama collection of the Mula Sarvastivada tradition. So this particular collection is about two-thirds complete collection of the Dirgha Agama, which has turned up on the black market about 10 years ago, and bits of it have been studied and published, but the process is still ongoing. So some other variants in the praises given by Chanki, that he sort of suitable for him to approach the Buddha because the Buddha had gone beyond future rebirth and taught a doctrine good in its beginning, middle and end. Moreover, in the Lokuttara Vada version, Chanki moreover mentioned that the Buddha dwelled in secluded places, was well supported, had reached the peaceful concentrative attainments, was superior to other recluses and Brahmins in his wisdom, and was endowed with unsurpassable knowledge and conduct. And whatever location the Buddha arrived, humans will be protected from demons. This way of highlighting the Buddha's protective powers reminds us of the Mahavastu, of course by the same school, the Lokuttaravadin school, which dwells on this subject to considerable length in its description of the Buddha's arrival at Vaisali. At which occasion he taught the Ratna Sutta. That particular episode is also described at length in the Pali commentaries, so I'm not sure if it's really distinctive of the Mahasanghika tradition, but anyway. The Mahavastu narrates that just as the Buddha's arrival caused all demons to leave Vaisali and therefore put an end to a plague, in several former existences of the Buddha as a hermit, an elephant and a bull, his presence had the same effect on demons. This emphasis on the protective aura caused by the presence of the Buddha might point to an additional affinity between the Chanki Sutra and the Mahavastu in addition to their linguistic similarities. So this is a kind of a speculation, it's a reasonable enough speculation. I'm not sure that there's really evidence enough to show that this kind of protective influence of the Buddha was more emphasized in the Mahasanghika tradition than elsewhere. But it's also interesting to consider that in the light of the Bamiyan Buddhas and to think, well, perhaps what is the purpose of them? And a sort of a construction as massive as that, which is, you know, sort of has the Buddha, showing out and presiding over the entire region and the entire plain, yeah, would quite likely have been seen as having like a protective influence over the area and being a way of manifesting the Buddha's presence for the area as a whole. Brahman Chanki, with the large company Brahmins, went to see the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. He exchanged courteous and amiable talk and sat down to one side. Now on that occasion the Blessed One was seated finishing some amiable talk with some very senior Brahmins. At the time sitting in the assembly was a Brahmin student named Gaupatika. Young Gaupatika. I wonder if that's a name. It might be just a name, but the etymology is similar to, could be analysed as bad, one on the wrong way. That's one way of etymologising his name. Whether that's the correct etymology or not, I'm not sure, but anyway. Young, shaven-headed, 16 years old, he was a master of the three Vedas with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology and etymology, and the histories as a fifth. Skilled in philology and grammar, he was fully versed in natural philosophy and the marks of a great man. while the senior Brahmins were conversing with the Blessed One, he repeatedly broke in and interrupted their talk. Then the Blessed One rebuked the Brahmin student Karpatika thus, "Let not the Venerable Bharadvaja," being of course his clan name, "break in and interrupt the talk of the very senior Brahmins while they are conversing. Let the Venerable Bharadvaja wait until the talk is finished." When this was said, the Brahmin Chanki said to the Blessed One, "Let not the best Master Gotama rebuke the Brahmin student Karpatika. He is a clansman of very learned, of good delivery and wise and capable of taking part in this discussion with Master Gotama." The Buddha thought, "Surely since the Brahmins honour him thus, the Brahmin student Karpatika must be accomplished in the scriptures of the three Vedas." And interesting little note head there, that one would have thought perhaps that the Buddha might have read his mind and known whether he was accomplished in the three Vedas, but apparently he only worked that out by inference. Yeah? Then the Brahmin student Karpatika thought, "When the recluse Gotama catches my eye, I'll ask him a question." Knowing with his own mind the thought in the Brahmin student Karpatika's mind, this one turned his eye towards him, and then Karpatika said, "Master Gotama, in regard to the ancient Brahmanic hymns that have come down through oral transmission, preserved in the collections, the Brahmins come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does Master Gotama say about this?" Okay, so here we have the challenge, setting up the debate. Idameva satyam mogmanyam. Let me just find the phrase. Okay, so here's the phrase itself. Idameva satyam mogmanyam vi. Okay, so here he's speaking in regards to their ancient texts. Yeah, their Puranam mantapadam, and here the manta being the mantra, of course referring to the Vedas. Iti hiti ha paramparaya. Probably referring to the ancient traditions in some way, legends and so on. Pitaka Sampadaya, those things included in the Pitaka. And therein the Brahmins come to the one-sided conclusion, Ekam Sena, literally one-sided. Yeah? Ekam meaning one, Ansa meaning a side. Ekam Sena Nityam Gacchanti. And notice the phrasing here, Ekam Sena Nipitang, yeah? Oh, sorry, Nitang is the conclusion, yeah? So the word Nipitang is to something that's concluded. So the Nitang Gatanti literally means to come to a conclusion, yeah? Or to literally go to a conclusion. And it's very similar to the English idiom. Yeah? So they come to this conclusion. Idameva satyam, only this is true. Moghamanyam, everything else is wrong. And the word mogha being related to the word moha and delusion. So it's even a bit stronger than saying something's wrong. It also has the suggestion that everything else is deluded, everything else is foolish, everything else is confused. Yeah? So it's a little bit stronger than saying it's merely incorrect. And what does Gotama say? Right? Of course, well known that Buddha rejected the authority of the Vedas, so it's a very challenging opening to a debate there. So the Buddha, again, you know, to notice, just as the last one, it's an interfaith dialogue, and the Buddha engaging with them, and he's not merely saying, "No, you're wrong, the Vedas are wrong because of this didn't happen, this one's wrong, this contradicts that," okay, he doesn't go there, but he engages with them. "How then, Bharadvaja, among the Brahmins, is there even a single Brahmin who says thus, 'I know this, I see this, only this is true, everything else is wrong'? In other words, is there anyone speaking from their own direct experience? Yeah? Do you actually see that the Vedas are in fact true and nothing else is true?" So he's not contesting his claim, but he's inquiring as to what is the basis of the claim. So this is a way of engaging someone. So this is very useful techniques to remember in terms of dialogue and engaging with people. That, you know, you're not putting somebody offside. Someone's made an aggressive stance, but then you're not responding to it with another aggressive stance. But you're saying, "Well, listen, you know, what do you think about this? What's the basis?" So you're engaging with it and you're constructing a dialogue. Very skillful, all of these things. Ahametang janami, ahametang pasami. I see this. I know this. So this kind of construction in Pali always refers to the duplication of knowing and seeing, is always emphasizing that kind of direct experience. No, hidang bho Gotama. No, good Gotama. Again, notice the use of bho as the Brahmanical title for the Buddha, as we saw in the last. Okay. Is there even a single... Next question. How then, Bharadvaja, among the Brahmins, is there even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher back to the seventh generation of teachers? I know this, I see this, only this is true, everything else is wrong. No, Master Gotama. Okay? So there's no... They don't even have a record in the past of a teacher or teacher's teacher who literally knew and saw all the truths in the Vedas. Uh-huh. Because...
The first statement, when he's been telling us the Vishnu, he's saying that the Brahmins, but just he's just referring to that. I'm just trying to clarify this. He's just referring to the ancient Brahmins, when he says that the Brahmins, they only did this during the wrong.
Right.
And then with the other two things, he's talking about what only
he's saying, do they know that the Vedas are true? Can you confirm that you claim that the Vedas are true? Can you confirm? Does anybody confirm that on the basis of their direct experience? Yeah, that's the question. So the term for teacher is acharya, eka acharya, so one teacher, and teacher's teacher is acharya, acharya. No, not even the teacher's teachers up to the seventh generation. Well, what about this? How then, Bharadvaja, do the ancient Brahman seers, the creators of the hymns, composers of the hymns, whose ancient hymns that were formerly chanted, uttered and compiled, the Brahmins nowadays still chant and repeat, repeating what was spoken and reciting what was recited. That is to say, Attaka, Vamaka, Vamadeva, Vesamita, Yamatagi, Angirasa, Bharadvaja, Vasetha, Kasapa and Bhagu. Did even these ancient Brahman seers say thus, we know this, we see this, only this is true, everything else is wrong. No, Master Gotama. So, 883... this list, of course, we've encountered many times, and being the standard list in the Pali of the seers to whom the ancient texts are attributed. Now, I haven't studied this point in detail. I can't remember off the top of my head. Many of these do correspond with the seers that the Brahmanical tradition itself attributes to the compilers of the seers of the Vedas. I can't recall off the top of my head whether all of them correspond or not, but certainly it's a similar list. So the Vedas, of course, being the, especially the Rig Veda, being held to have been sort of seen rather than composed, and it's probably quite an accurate way of putting it that the Vedas were something which sort of came out of a state of divine inspiration. So maybe it's like a state of ecstasy or a state of trance, and being sort of entering into some kind of sort of a spontaneous poetic ecstasy or rapture where these verses would come out of, rather than being sort of composed in a more sort of clinical style as prose texts or much later poetry was. So these were regarded as being the seers of the verses rather than composers. So they were in a way channeling the gods. But even they didn't claim, only this is true, everything else is wrong. So Bharadvaja, the Buddha goes on, Bharadvaja, it seems that among the Brahmins there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among Brahmins there's not even a single teacher or teacher's teacher. Suppose there were, and he repeats the admissions which the Brahman Kampatika Bharadvaja had made, and he says, suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. First one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, Bharadvaja, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think, Bharadvaja? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? Right? So here, at this point, the Buddha's like, no more Mr. Nice Guy. And, you know, he's built up a serious case based on reason and so on. But he's not kind of wishy-washy. He's not just concerned to simply agree with everything that they might say, but he's going to engage with it seriously. And now that he's got the Brahmin student to admit this much, then he says, well, what is your basis?
That's right.
And of course the blind leading the blind becoming famous in many contexts. Okay, so but Kapatika, being a good debater, he's intelligent and educated. He may not be all that mature, but he's only 16, so give him a break. He then takes up the argument again. He says it's not only out of faith, out of sadha or conviction. So this, we'll now use Venerable Tanisaro's translation on the screen, but I'm still reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation here, as Google Books has skipped out the next few pages of it, so we don't have access to that on a soft copy. So it's not only out of faith that the Brahmins honour this, they also honour it as an unbroken tradition, as an oral tradition. Okay, English statement here, we don't but also as an oral tradition. Anusava, Anusava. And it's good that you just mentioned the Dhammacakka, because it actually is the same word, virtually the same word that's actually mentioned in the Dhammacakka itself. Yeah? So in the, if you're familiar with the Dhammacakka, it says pubbe anusuddhamesu, something like that. So those dhammas which have been not heard before. So in the past, so notice that the un here is a negative, so we have anusutta, and sutta here being the not, this is not the sutta as in the sutta, as in the text sutta, as being a different word, but here sutta meaning literally what is heard, and this is the past participle of the same word here, sava. So it's actually the same word, it's just a different grammatical case of it. So this is simply those things which are on and anu, the prefix being along with or following. Okay, so the anusutta or the anusava is those things which have been heard, passed down through hearing or passed down through oral tradition, heard one after the other. Yeah? So this is the meaning of anusava. Anusutta is those things that are heard one after the other. So the Buddha's explicitly claiming that his teaching is not based on those things which were heard and passed down through an oral tradition. That's the meaning of those, that phrase in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Okay. Anusavapetha brahmana pariyupasanti. And the Buddha says, well, first of all, you relied on faith, and then now you rely on oral tradition. Right? And he goes on to say, well, there are five dhammas which here and now can have two kinds of results. There are five dhammas. Dhyotheva dhamme, in this present moment or at this present time, can lead to two kinds, dvedha vipaka. So here being vipaka being result. So of course normally we're used to the word vipaka using the sense of kama vipaka, yeah, the results of action. So here vipaka used in another sense, meaning the outcome of something in general. So what are the five? Okay, so this is the important basis, and this of course found in the Kalama Sutta and others. Sabha Ruchi Anusavo Akara Paritako Dipi Nidhana Kanti. So these five dhammas being these are five ways of knowing, okay? So five what they call pamana in the Buddhist epistemology is ways of knowing. How do we actually learn things? How do we know things? So these five: faith, sadha, so we know something because of faith; ruchi, we know because of preference, or at least we think we know. It's not saying we actually know these things because of these things, but it's we think we know something because of preference. We have a liking for something. It suits us, yeah. It suits us to believe a certain thing. Anusavo is oral tradition, something that's passed down from oral tradition. Akara parivitako is this one is quite a difficult one to work out exactly. Parivitaka is thinking or reflecting, and akara can have a number of different meanings. It could mean the aspects, so it could mean thinking, reflecting on different aspects of a thing, or it could have a meaning of being reasoned reflection. And this particular passage was discussed in detail by Sri Lankan scholar, Buddhist theory of knowledge. No, it was Kalapahana's teacher, Jayatilaka, yeah, Jayatilaka's book, Early Buddhist Theories of Knowledge. So he discussed this in some detail. And it's on that basis that Bhikkhu Bodhi's done his translation here of reasoned cogitation. So taking akara to mean reason rather than the aspects of something. I had some discussion with Bhikkhu Bodhi about this particular point, and he said that was what he thought that was what that meant there. And dhyapi nidhana kanti is a reflective acceptance of a view, and here the word kanti meaning acceptance. Okay, so we're more familiar with the word kanti in the sense of patience and patient endurance. It's very commonly used in Buddhism in that sense. Yeah, it's kanti, but it also means the acceptance of something, particularly the acceptance of a view. And this is important not only within the Pali texts, but it's particularly important to know this in the if you're studying the Mahayana texts, because there are often in the various stages of the Bodhisattva Bhumi and so on, you find this word kanti has been there and it's been mistranslated, and it's usually always translated as being patience. And you find these very curious translations where the Bodhisattva is said to have a certain kind of patience or certain kind of this and that, whereas it doesn't mean patience at all, it actually means acceptance. So it's the Bodhisattva's acceptance is used in the same sense as it's used here. And ditti, of course, meaning a view, and nidhana, from the root, same root jhana, as the word jhana for meditation that we know, but the word, when prefixed with nidhana means to ponder or to think deeply about something. So the acceptance of a view after pondering it. Okay, this is in a way similar to the akara parivitako, but akara parivitako is referring to a process more what in the West is referred to as pure reason. Okay, so it would be reflecting and coming to an idea based on first principles. So, for example, in the way that say Descartes did, yeah. So you go back to first principles and you work out something on the basis of pure logic, whereas dipi nijana kanti is accepting of a view after pondering, and it refers especially to views which you may hear from outside as well. So now the Buddha then goes on. So all of these things, notice that the Buddha doesn't dismiss any of these things, right? He's not saying any of these things are wrong, right? And you shouldn't have them. Nor is he saying that they're particularly right. He's saying that they can have two outcomes. And it's important to notice that, and also in the context of the Kalama Sutta, that it's very often said that the Buddha rejects mere faith and embraced reason, whereas that's not the case at all. The Buddha, in fact, is putting both faith and reason in the similar kind of category, saying both of these can lead to two outcomes. Something may be fully accepted out of faith, and yet may be hollow, empty and false. Something may not be fully accepted out of faith, and yet it may be factual, true and unmistaken. And again, something might be fully approved of, well transmitted, well cogitated, or well reflected on, and yet it may be false, but something may be not. well reflected upon and so on, and yet may be true. Under these conditions, it's not proper for a wise man who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Okay, so it's a very important point here. And so notice how the Buddha is setting up a certain degree of epistemological skepticism. Right? He's saying, well, you can't believe everything you hear. You can't believe that something just because it seems good to you. You can't believe something because you've just worked it out according to your own logic, because sometimes these things are right and sometimes they're not. So then Bharadvaja goes on to ask the Buddha, okay, well, in what way is there the preservation of truth, the satjanu rakana hoti? And how does one preserve the truth? I asked you about the preservation of truth. Now, this is very interesting phrasing here that the Buddha's introduced and the Brahman is following up on it, the preservation of truth. Now, what it's not talking about necessarily is how to find what is true, right? But what it's talking about is about how one can preserve one's speech so as to not misrepresent the truth in one's speech, okay? And this is, I think it's very remarkable, this kind of degree of sophistication. Now, it's exactly, what the Buddha is going to teach here is exactly the same principle that Wikipedia is based on. Right? Wikipedia is not based on what's true, it's based on what you can find a reference for. Okay? So you can put anything could be false on Wikipedia, but it has to be referenced, ideally anyway. That's the basic idea. So so you know that. So when you're reading it, you know that this is the standard. So there's a clarity. So the truth is preserved. So when something is presented there, it's not saying this is true. What it's saying is, well, this has been stated in such and such a study, or such and such a reference, or such and such an authority, and this is why we put it up there. So this is the preservation of truth. So go and see how the Buddha is talking about this. Yeah. I think it's a different sense. Yeah, it's not referring to the maintenance of a set of facts or a set of principles or whatever, but it's talking about the way that our way that when we're speaking, that we can be sure that we're preserving truth in our speech and the way that we talk about things. Yeah, I think that's the principle it's getting to here. Okay. If a person has faith, the Buddha goes on, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. Eva me sadha. That's how he preserves the truth. But he doesn't therefore come to the one-sided conclusion, ekam sena nittang gacchati, edam eva satchang mogamanyang. Only this is true, everything else is false. Similarly, if he has a preference, a liking for something, a vruchi, then, or he has knows something by oral tradition, or by reflecting on reasoned reflection, or by acceptance of a view after pondering it, he doesn't come to the idea that only this is true, everything else is false. Yeah? But he preserves truth by saying, this is my preference, this is my oral tradition, this is my reasoned reflection, or this is my acceptance of a view after pondering it. This is how you preserve the truth. But as yet, there is no discovery of truth. There's no satjanu bodha. Okay, so the root here being bodhi. Yeah, there's no awakening to the truth. There's no penetration. It's merely preserving. So what it says is that the statement that you're making has neither more nor less truth in it than your sources. That's effectively what it's saying. So you're preserving the degree of truth or falsity of whatever the source is that you're transmitting. And it's again, very, very subtle and very refined point. It's something that we're quite used to because, you know, we've been taught this way. Yeah? But Buddha's coming up with this very subtle insight, isn't it? Yeah? That because we all have that tendency to sort of overstate things. Yeah? So there's this tendency to get something and then to make more out of it, which is very prominent in the spiritual traditions, and particularly, of course, as the Buddha's shown already, in the Brahmanical tradition, where the texts themselves are not claiming to be perfect, flawless presentations of the truth, but they're claiming that they are whatever they are. They're not making that kind of claim for themselves, but the later followers of it do make that claim for them. The same thing we see in the Bible, that the Bible itself doesn't claim to be the perfect word of God and all of these kinds of things. It claims to be the reports and accounts of various people and various the episodes and so on. And so it's people much later who make these kind of fundamentalist claims. And of course, is exactly the same in Buddhism. That very often the Buddhist scriptures don't claim to be the word of the Buddha. Some scriptures do, others don't. But people come along later and make these claims on behalf of the scriptures, when very often the claims are not made within the scriptures themselves. The Brahman Bharavaja then says, in that way we recognize the preservation of truth, but how is there the discovery of truth? In what way does one discover the truth? So we're going beyond merely maintaining the same level of truth or falsity as our sources have, and we want to actually discover the truth with the anubodha, satchamanubuddhati, to actually realize the truth. Okay, so the Buddha goes on to answer this question: how do you penetrate the truth? Here, Bharadvaja, a bhikkhu may be living in dependence on some village or town. Then a householder's son goes to him and investigates him in regard to three kinds of dhammas based on greed, hatred, and delusion. Are there in this venerable one any dhammas based on greed, such as obsessed by these states, not knowing, he might say, I know, or not seeing, he might say, I see, or he might urge others to act in such a way that would lead to their harm and suffering for a long time? As he investigates him, he comes to know there are no such dhammas based on greed. The bodily behavior of this venerable one are not those of one affected by greed, and the dhamma that this venerable one teaches is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. And just to notice here is the nature of the realization of the dhamma, and the word, just want to point out the because we've been using these words for reason earlier, but here it says not attainable by mere reason is ataka vacharo, which is not exactly the same. Taka is the word for reason, not the same as the words for reason that we've had in the previous list of five ways of knowing. Okay, and then he investigates him on dhammas based on hate and on dhammas based on delusion in the same way. When he's investigated him and seen that he's purified from dhammas based on delusion, he places faith in him. Filled with faith, he visits him and pays respects to him. Having paid respects to him, he gives ear. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teachings he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he's gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. Resolutely striving, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. In this way, Bharadvaja, there is the discovery of truth. In this way, one discovers truth. In this way, we describe the discovery of truth. But there is, as yet, no final arrival at the truth. At which point, you go, well, crikey, right? I mean, he's already given what seems to be a pretty, comprehensive teaching there, and pretty demanding already, and someone's already penetrated and witnessed the Dhamma and all of these things. But he's still not the final arrival of truth. So it's showing the standards, the high standards that the Buddha had. So just to come back to here and just to remark how the Buddha's injunction and on the student, it's the student's responsibility, a good student, to investigate the teacher and to really find out, well, what's actually going on here, what are they teaching, is this harmful, is this not, and so on. And to make sure that their faith in that teacher and that teaching are well placed before practicing it. And so this, of course, is a very important quality, and I think also quite rare among spiritual teachers to actually set up such a stringent standard for what a spiritual teacher actually should be. Then and then this gradual process of coming closer and closer to the truth, So the first is you have faith in them. The faith is just the first stage, So people often say that Buddhism doesn't have faith in the same way that other religions do, but this is, of course, is a misunderstanding. Well, the actual case is Buddhism has faith is very important in Buddhism, but it plays a different kind of role in Buddhism than it does in a lot of other religions. And in Christianity, you often seem to find this idea that faith is almost preferable or superior to knowledge, whereas in Buddhism, faith is always seen as being a preliminary stage in the development of real knowledge. So with the arising of faith, he visits and grows close to him. Going close, he lends ear. I'm going to show the Pali for this one. Okay, so he approaches him in Pariyupasati, and then he comes and he lends an ear, sotang odahati, literally bends down his ear. So then when he's bent down his ear, he listens to the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he remembers it, dhareti, okay, bears it in mind. So those Dhammas that he's remembered, attang upa parikati, he investigates the meaning. Yeah, so the meaning of the Dhamma, the atta. So seeing, not just taking it on faith, but investigating and inquiring it. And then when he's investigated and inquired into that Dhamma, then nidhyanam kamanti. So he comes to a reflective acceptance of those Dhammas. So we have now Dhamma nidhyanam kanti, whereas the phrase we had a bit earlier was ditti nidhyanam kanti. So this being a subtle, obviously the same epistemological process, but the difference between the Dhamma and the ditti. So sometimes ditti is used in a number of different ways, but sometimes it's used in a slightly pejorative sense. So in that way that the views are more like the kind of the outsider's views or the wrong views and so on, whereas the Dhamma here meaning the truth. So when there's the acceptance of the truth, chando jayati, yeah? Enthusiasm is born. And when the enthusiasm is born, usahati, one puts forth effort. Usahitva tuleti, then one scrutinizes. Tulayitva padahati, then one strives. So these ones in here aren't entirely clear what the logic or the difference is between these. They're fairly much synonyms in most of the time. One who's striving, samano kayena ceva parma satchang sachhi karoti. So what these one realizes or witnesses the ultimate truth with the body and sees it with wisdom. So these refer to the two aspects of practice and meditation of samatha and vipassana, samadhi and wisdom. And seeing the ultimate truth with the body. This idea of seeing with the body is a phrase, it's an idiom, which is always closely associated with the experience of samadhi. Okay, so this is talking about somebody who's practiced at samadhi and developed it, and so that they see the ultimate truth, paramasacham, okay, being nibbana, with the body. And important to notice that paramasaccha is only used in this sense in the early canon. So we don't have the distinction between relative truth or conventional truth and ultimate truth, which is made much of in some of the later Buddhist philosophies. In the early suttas, paramasaccha, or the ultimate truth, is only found in this sense of being the word for nibbana. And then having penetrated it with wisdom, then one sees it. So this is those two. But still, is an awakening to truth, but is not a final arrival at truth. Okay, so it seems like a paradoxical statement. In fact, what it means is that these phrases refer to the stream enterer, essentially. Yeah? And so then we're now talking about the higher path to arahantship. The final arrival at truth. So how does the final arrival at truth, and then how is that brought about? And the Buddha then says, final arrival at truth is come from the asevana bhavana bahuli kama, the cultivating, developing and making much of those very same things, te sanyeva dhamma. Okay, those very same dhammas, keep on doing them, keep on repeating them, and so on, and then this is one will reach the final arrival at truth. And so this relates to the development, the bhavana of the Noble Eightfold Path by one who's already a stream enterer and is making much of those things until realizing arahantship. Okay. Now then, the text then goes on to basically present the same teaching in a different way, and that is by going from in reverse order, from the final arrival of truth. Chanki asks at each stage which is the most helpful for arriving at that. So what's most helpful for arriving at the final arrival at truth? striving is most helpful for the final arrival at truth, what's most helpful for striving, scrutiny, and then backwards through application of the will, zeal, reflective acceptance of the teachings, examination of the meaning, memorizing the teachings, hearing the Dhamma, giving ear, paying respect, visiting, and faith. Okay, so going backwards through all these things. So, of course, that being a slightly repetitive framework, but being very good in the oral tradition, of course, reminding you of all of those things. Finally, Bhairavaraja repeats that he's asked for all of those questions and that the Buddha has answered them and satisfied him whatever he has asked. Formerly, he goes on, we used to think, who are those bald-pated recluses, those swarthy menial offspring of the kinsman's feet, that they would understand the Dhamma? But Master Gotama has indeed inspired in me a love for recluses, confident in recluses, and reverence for recluses. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who's gone to him for refuge for life. So Buddha manages to convert him. So this sutta is a very important one and very interesting in showing that Buddhist approach to truth and how to realize, and showing quite a sophisticated understanding of the epistemology and the ways of coming to truth. And something, as the Buddha is always, he's always kind of not non-reductive. Okay, so it's interesting to bear that in mind. Often these days we might hear teachers who teach, you know, just be mindful, yeah, or whatever, you know, just study this or something. And there's always this tendency to oversimplify things. And so the Buddha always puts things in their place and puts things in a perspective. Yeah, okay, having faith is good, yeah, but then that's not just enough by itself. You've got to go listen to the teachings, yeah, pay attention. You've got to try to memorize them, remember what they are. It's no good to just sit there and listen and think, oh, that's a lovely Dhamma talk, and then walk out and then you can't remember anything, yeah? And then you've got to not just remember them, but you have to investigate, you have to reflect on it. What does it actually mean? And then you reflect that when what these teachings are saying is that we have to put effort to realize the teaching. So you have to reflect, okay, well, I've got to strive, I've got to try to do my best. And then gradually, through repeating these things again and again, then we come to actually realize the truth itself. Not directly, yeah, certainly not emphasizing meditation. It's not emphasizing so much. Some of these words are kind of shorthand references to meditation. The word for striving, padahati, always means striving in meditation. And again, that idiom of realizing with your body is a common idiom used in a samadhi context. So it's kind of implied, but you're quite right that it's not the focus of this particular sutta, yeah. You know, again, that's coming from the background of it, that he's talking to scholars rather than talking to meditators.
And the word like scrutinizing.
Yeah.
Tulati.
Dhamma vichaya?
Yeah, Dhamma.
Exactly, the same kind of thing as Dhamma vichaya, yeah. Tulati is not a term that's not used that frequently in the suttas, but it becomes quite a common Abhidhamma term where it means exactly that. Yeah, yeah. And it's quite astonishing because, again, I mean, I think the Pali suttas are the first to express these things in such a clear and sophisticated way, but certainly it's in the same spirit as the Upanishads, and the Upanishads are constantly saying, Ya evam Veda, you know, one who knows this, is constantly saying, you know, you don't just do these things out of rote, but you have to reflect on it. And this is the kind of the main refrain in all the Upanishads, and yet, as you say, it's still still rare, yeah. I mean, and this is, I think it's an important thing to notice. I mean, in terms of, you know, we often say, from a Buddhist point of view, we're often saying, oh, you know, don't get hung up on reason and logic and so on, which is fair enough for people who know how to use reason and logic, but most people in the world don't. And for them, it's actually important that they learn how to think, yeah, and they learn how to use reason and so on. And if you sort of try to skip that and go straight to meditation, then you're inviting trouble, really. But just to come back briefly to the comparative study of these, I won't go into all of the details, but just a couple of differences between the Changi Sutta, the Mahasanghika Lokuttara Vada version, They suggest that its version, the existing fragments, don't seem to refer to the five sources of knowledge, okay? But rather they took up truth claims based on what is seen, heard, sensed and cognized. Okay? Whereas the Sarvastivada version does seem to have a reference to examination and reasoning, which suggests that its version may have similar to the Pali. So in other words, this is the Sanskrit phrase svākāra parivitarkam, which is similar to the Pali we've seen, is akāra parivitaka. The same line continues, however, with sudrishti nijha, which is a phrase similar, though not identical, to dhiti nijhana kanti. So again, these are just fragments that we've got here. Whereas the Mahasanghika version seems to refer to drishtang, shrutang, mutang and vijñātang, rather than the list we found in the Pali, which seems to have also found in the Sanskrit. So that tells us a number of things. One is that the Pali and Sarvastivada texts are closer together, and the Mahasanghika text is a little bit further different, which is what we would expect. In these different forms, we can't conclude from this though that there's any substantial difference between the doctrines of these, because it's very likely that that this list of five dhammas is found elsewhere in the Mahasanghika text. It's merely absent from this particular spot, but it's quite often found elsewhere. Now, this list of the what is seen, heard, thought and cognized is a standard list found all through the Buddhist texts and is derived from the Upanishads, where we find exactly the same list. Just for the point of view of clarity, the word mutta is often translated according to the commentary as sensed, and implying what is smelt, tasted and touched, but that's clearly incorrect. It doesn't mean what it's sensed. Mutta means what is thought. Okay, so something that's been thought out, whereas vijñātang means something that's known or experienced. Now, with this group of dhammas, what is seen, heard, thought and cognized, it seems to be much more reliant on direct experience than that list of five dhammas that we find in the Pali, yeah? Faith, preference, oral tradition, reasoning and so on. Yeah? So we seem to be moving towards a doctrine of direct experience. Yeah? However, when you look closely at the way that this group is used, often it's actually used in a way that's much more similar to that. Dipta and sutta refers not to something which is heard, but to something which is, again, is part of the oral tradition. Okay? And dipta meaning like a view or an opinion or something like that. So the phrasing in itself is a bit ambiguous. This is one of the things that Jayatilaka showed in the early Buddhist theory of knowledge, that these are mainly referring to those things which are, again, sort of in that realm of views, opinions, tradition and so on, rather than direct experience. And this being a list which is found frequently in Brahmanical contexts, such as in the Parayana Vagga of the Sutta Nipata. So so even though they seem to be somewhat different, but they're probably not as different in their meaning as they are, just a slight difference in the phrasing. And the point here being made in the Chanki Sutta, as Analia said, they indicate the problem to arise as soon as truth claims are made based on what is seen, heard, etc., but without having reached personal realization. Because obviously we can, even something which is seen and heard either directly or through a tradition can be mistaken as well. Okay, so one slight difference between the two, when it's talking about the investigation of a monk, whether they have greed, hatred and delusion, in the Chanki Sutta it refers to the Buddha himself and not to just any old monk. So the Chanki Mahasanghika Lokuttaravada version includes an extra step in there, not mentioned in the Pali, which after the desiring of the practice is the arising of joy. And so that's an interesting one, of course found many places elsewhere in the suttas, but not found in this particular case. Pramodyam, Pali Pramodya. So some slight differences in the sequence, again the Sarvastivada version having the Dhamma which is remembered, one should think about it, reflect on it, and the Dhamma which, having thought about it, one should scrutinize it or analyze it, and having scrutinized or examined, one should uparikshate, again meaning to investigate or examine. I'm not 100% sure of the exact difference between these, but obviously referring to a deepening process of reflection and analysis of a sutta. Okay, so the remaining part of the discourse hasn't been preserved in Sanskrit, so we only have the Pali for the rest of it, for the outcome. Okay, so that's the Chanki Sutta.
I'm curious that it's called Chanki, and he had really nothing to do with it, except that he actually just tripped to see the Buddha.
Yeah, true enough. In the Sarvastivada version, is called the Karmatika Sutta, named after the Brahman, yeah. So the naming of it is a bit arbitrary, yeah. Could have been a prestige thing, yeah, the fact that it was more orientated to the prestige of him going along. Yeah.
Well,
this
applies to such a thing. Yeah. Do you think it's hierarchical? Because it starts to seem more emotionally
based. Right, yeah, very much so.
It seems that it's intellectual based.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's the sutta is, and the list is not explicit in that regard, although it's very common that, you know, the later ones are more, you know, the things get more profound as they go along. It's the normal way things go in Buddhism. But it's certainly quite correct to say that the first two are primarily emotional. Anusavo is primarily based on an external source, and then belief and tradition, and then the last two are based more primarily intellectual. So there certainly is that difference. Whether it implies one of them is better than the other is, yeah, interesting. I mean, you might, but it's kind of less normal. I mean, for example, you know, you might be, as I know a few people who are, say, linguists, and so maybe you start because you're just interested in Indian languages, and then you start to read Pali and so on, and then you actually start to get interested because of that. But it might be originally that it's purely an intellectual inquiry, so it could, that's one way it could go. But I think, you know, rather than saying one's better than the other, you say that they have different roles in the structure, you know, coming to the truth. They're actually both essential. They're both part of that coming to a penetration of truth. Yeah. But faith may be more basic. Well, in the sequence later on, it talks about you have faith first, and then you go and see them and then receive the teachings. Well, it's through that investigation, you know, does this speaker have greed, hatred, and delusion? Do they... The initial faith. But it's interesting though, because it's, you know, it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. So in a sense, you know, it's saying it is going back to saying that the intellectual thing is prior, because it's saying actually the scrutiny and examination should be done before putting faith. Yeah.
So I think it's not just you do this and then you do that.
Right.
I mean, the faith has to be there. Everything is there all along, in some way or another.
Yeah. Okay, so any more questions before we finish up? I'll finish by paying respects.